for downloading the Design Intent. We are about to embark on a conversation with a friend named Stephen Wittenbrock, who is a retired industrial designer. We felt like it would be interesting to get the, we wanted to get the insights from someone who has been and had a full life as a designer, from starting in the early 70s to retiring this year. He's seen a lot in the industry change, and we felt like he was a great person to have a talk with.
Yeah. And this week's podcast is brought to you by Urbanist Cycling, your go-to brand for stylish and functional cycling underwear. UrbanistCycling.com.
Welcome, Stephen Wittenbrock, to the Design Intent. It's Dan, Aaron, and Tony. We wanted to talk to you a little bit about your design career. I know recently you've retired. I think you and I, we've known each other for a while, although it's been quite a long time since we've had a chance to talk and catch up. So this will give us a good opportunity to do that.
I have a number of questions as well, just as sort of a fellow person who's been in consulting a while. So I have some questions as well.
Yeah, and kind of the you know, having Dan and myself is that we kind of see design through two different perspectives, obviously, you know, me being in corporate, Dan being in consulting, and it gives us an opportunity to kind of just talk to people and have, because we have different perspectives on design and how design happens. Yeah. And design in business, and design is more than just trying to make something. There's a lot of relationships and things that have to take place, obviously, in order for someone such as yourself to survive for so long as a designer.
Yeah. And Aaron's viewpoint is interesting as well as a part of this, because he's got a few years under his belt, but you know, as someone who's newer than the old crotchety folks, yeah, to design, has a fresher perspective on things. So.
Yeah, Dan and I both have kids older than Aaron.
No, actually.
Well, not too far.
Not too far, yeah.
Let's start there. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe where you went to your education, where you went to school, and just some sort of hop across your career path for some highlights.
And why you decided to do industrial design as well.
I didn't hear that last part.
Oh, also why you decided to go into industrial design.
Okay. Well, we could start there. That's really simple. The idea I can build an object that I can hold in my hand is the reason I became an industrial designer. As odd as that sounds, but it's the intimacy of something small and precious versus architecture, which is manipulating large spaces. And actually, that's where I started. So I joined the architectural program at the University of Washington a number of years ago. And suddenly, after the first year, I was very disenchanted with architecture per se and where I saw the field going. And so I started searching and actually through accident ran across industrial design, the field of industrial design. And at the time, the it was a five-year program that required hard sciences before you could enter the School of Art. So I had to finish calculus, physics, engineering, mechanical engineering programs, and that curriculum certainly doesn't exist today, not to my knowledge. And then at the fourth year, I became disenchanted with a senior instructor. And so I ran across a school just starting in California called CalArts, which Disney funded and never saw before he passed. And so I went there, but thank goodness I went there, because I ran across a designer, Louis Danziger, who actually introduced me in literal terms to what it is a designer does in terms of solving a problem. It has nothing to do with aesthetics. And Louis actually was still teaching at Art Center up until just a couple of years ago, he was 94, if you can believe that. And anyway, so I left CalArts and I went to work in Silicon Valley for a consulting firm by the name of Clement Laboratories. And so this is 1973-ish. And one of the first projects I worked on was the Alto computer, which is Xerox PARC's first device that Jobs and Wozniak came across. So it has a unique display, keyboard, three-button mouse, and the differentiating issue was it was the first GUI, graphical user interface. And then from there, I worked in a number of corporations to get familiar with the corporate life, and one consulting office in Colorado, then joined a startup in 1982 that had $32 million in funding in 1982. And I was asked to manage the ID, ME, and regulatory compliance activities for that company. The company failed after 4 years. It had funding from GE, IBM. It was building a full-scale VLSI workstation. At that point, I don't want to keep going here, so I'll make this short. At any rate, at that point, I thought I could start my own business. And so that's what I did. In 1992, I started my own business. And the rest is history.
Wow. And so you, in that startup, were you in Portland or you were in Silicon Valley?
Still? Yes.
So you were in Portland. So you are yeah. from the Northwest. So is Dan. But are you from Washington State or are you originally from Portland?
Washington State. Actually, okay. my father was intimately involved in Richland. I don't know, or Hanford.
Oh, wow. Okay.
1943.
Wow, down in the Tri-Cities.
Yes. So I grew up understanding plutonium. And
yeah, they've had some problems in Hanford, I hear.
Oh, really?
Yes, they have. That's another discussion.
So you started in 1992 in Portland, Oregon. And you, how big was your firm at its most? So how many people did you have working for you?
You know, initially it was just my partner and I, Frank Friedman, and the two of us for a number of years. But then we grew to, it was essential we bring on a mechanical engineer, and because of the kinds of projects we were doing. And we were actually working, well, the kinds of work we did and how we distinguished ourselves was full cycle product development. So yes, we do the front end conceptual work, but then once the client felt comfortable with the conceptual direction, we'd physically engineer it and then find a manufacturer to mass produce it, because this was in the day where we were creating and building objects. It wasn't about a digital world and so we went from two people to five, and soon we were at 12, and that was as large as, I actually got to 15 for a year, and then I really didn't like the fact we were of that size, because I found myself further and further from what I loved, which was design. So we pulled back to 12, and then we went to 10. And in the last days of the firm, we were at a core of four, and then we used outside consultants.
Nice. So your last few years, you've been doing a lot of medical work. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, because medical work is pretty interesting. I got to do some medical device design, and I always found it very satisfying compared to a lot of other things, just because it's you literally do solve lots of problems, and it's either really complicated or not as complicated as it might seem sometimes, depending on the type of product that you're working on.
Well, I really don't. So for the last 5 to 6 years, it's been strictly, except for working with an aviation company, it's been medical product development for OHSU, which is a research university here in Portland that Phil Knight from Nike has funded. In fact, there's a school, a cancer research program named after Knight, and he's recruited some amazing physicians to join, to live in Portland and work here. And so one of the first projects we worked on was a remote endarterectomy. And what it is I'll never forget when the doctor asked me to help him. He gave me a napkin sketch, literally. And I looked at it and I said, so first of all, what does this device do? It enters the femoral artery and removes the blockage of plaque. And you understand what we're talking about here in terms of scale. And I said, first off, I told him I have no idea where I'm going to start here, but I'll put together a team and we will construct and only pursue a proof of concept. And so literally 2.5 years later, we had developed a device that he used on a cadaver that entered the femoral artery, and it was using basically the entire product was made of nitinol, which is an amazing material. And there's a wire loop, and the vein itself is comprised of three layers. And so the concept we settled on was the loop. There are actually tools that exist that can delaminate the vein that size, which is amazing in and of itself. Once the vein from the outer to the mid layer is delaminated, our loop from the nitinol would enter through force and go down the artery by the blockage. Then we'd collapse the loop, sever this inner sausage layer, and extract the plaque. This has nothing to do with ID. But it was the coolest thing, solving the problem. I couldn't believe that it worked, but it did. So,
wow.
And then the other thing that we did that is more along the ID realm is, a German company, Biotronics, which competes with Medtronic, they're a $1 billion company. They asked me to come in and discuss helping them develop a new tool it's a surgical tool for implant a cardiac monitor. And I said, I'd be happy to do that, but I'm first going to need to interview surgeons that complete this task with your existing tool set. So the existing tool was two tools. One tool that would create in the chest area, I can get into the specifics, but you create an incision in the chest, then you insert this tool to create a cavity, then another tool has the device in it, which is then inserted, and you remove the secondary tool and suture the site closed. And it stays in the body for about 4 years, monitoring 24/7 everything your heart's doing, and sends that signal remotely to a physician who captures and monitors all of this. Back to my discussion with the client, I said, I need to interview wherever these people are that actually do this and watch what they do. And they said, their initial response is, no, we didn't budget for that. I said, well, okay, you're talking to the wrong designer. So the conversation ended, I left, and about a month later, they called and said, we've reconsidered, we'd like you to get started. So over the next 6 months, I traveled to the Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Center, California's diverse centers in California, Washington, Oregon, and what I would do is interview the surgeons. So these are electrocardiologists, the most educated people you can see or meet, and they are an eccentric group of individuals. And I would interview them before the surgery, go into the surgical center and watch and videotape what they were doing, and then interview them afterwards. And we did this for 9 surgeons. And we understood what surgeons really were on top of their game and which weren't. And they were using the existing tool set. So the objective was, in my mind, instead of 2 tools, which took 10 minutes to complete this entire process, was to go to 1 tool that did it all and be used in an outpatient clinic at some point, and versus in a surgical center. So finished the interviews, learned a great deal, summarized our findings, and then started the conceptual work. And our first concepts were off the mark. It was a tough problem. But then sitting down with my ME one night, we started talking and figured out a radically different approach than what Medtronic had been doing. So there were some IP issues here we couldn't ignore and that I won't get into here. Anyway, we came up with a concept. It was one tool. We built 3D models, you know, SLA stuff. Took those tools and used them on cadavers. Pigs. That's
some hardcore research.
The sheep and the models being refined, then on cadavers. And then they told me, you're competing with our German internal team in Germany. And we want you to know that your concept is somewhat better than what they've done. So I don't really care. I'm going to do what I'm doing. And it either meets the mark or it's not. So anyway, the tool is now in the market. I could send you a video of it. We won the competition. It takes, so you make an incision and you can literally count to 10 seconds, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. And you watch a surgeon make the incision. That's where I start counting. He inserts the tool, creates the cavity, turns. Anyway, it's a real interesting mechanism. It releases the device in the body. He extracts it. Now, that 10 seconds does not include suturing the site closed, but it's very slick, and they're very happy with it. So, sorry to ramble on so long.
No, that's very cool. That's the very neat part about, I think, medical design is that type of problem solving, because it's not about aesthetics. It's about the function and
and obviously, you know, when you're talking about practicing things on cadavers, you know, that's, you're not fooling around there with you know, trifling with simple things. That's very serious.
Well, it was the first time I'd ever done it, and I was surprised at every detail in this facility is controlled. Every detail. Not only are they videotaping what you happen to be working on, they're videotaping anything in the room that is taking place, and the animals were all alive. So there was a person there who was monitoring these animals' health, their breathing, their every aspect of them. It was an extremely controlled environment. which is all news to me.
I have a question. Now, this is obviously a completely but somewhat related topic, maybe a little more lighthearted than surgery like that. But so, yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's good. So in terms of sort of your career and sort of personal development, so when you get to, because Tony and I are maybe, you know, we sort of see this coming in the hopefully not, well, hopefully far distance, but so if you take sort of the finances out of the picture, so for you, I guess, what was the thing or the process that brought you to the point of saying, I think it's time for me to retire and maybe do something different?
You know, for me, it was my age. So when I passed 70, I decided it was time to, but I've been thinking about this for a while.
Right.
I wanted to depart from what I was doing. To be frank, design has changed to such a degree over where I started. And I was no longer enjoying the people I was meeting and their understanding of design and where they wanted to take it. It was a means to increase ROI. It was a means, this is not ever shared with me, but it was clearly understood by me that the motivations to bring great products to market for me, and from my perspective, seem to have disappeared. So I run into a lot of passionate CEOs, but that doesn't mean they're really, and their entire organization is committed to design. We don't bring products to market. We develop them, but we don't bring them to market.
Yeah. So I guess your sort of your personal satisfaction in the state of, you know, and your experience of the design industry became more and more misaligned. Does that
sound? Yes.
Okay.
That's spot on.
Okay. And that actually brings me to my next question, because this is kind of something that I feel like I struggle with, and maybe I'm describing a similar thing. And maybe Tony, you find the same thing. So I feel like as I've grown in my career and gotten older, I feel like my design skills and design sense has improved all along the way, but I do find a certain amount of, I don't know what I would call it, like social disconnect or understanding of, you know, I'm a part of my generation and there's generations that have come since, and I find, you know, how do I keep up with, you know, the following generations? In terms of, you know, the social aspects and what's important to them and all those kinds of things that aren't really hard sciences, but they still play into, you know, culture and what it is.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay.
So you're...
No, I guess the question is how did you stay relevant, let's say? You know, that's what I'm saying. I still think from a design sense, I think I'm getting better and better, but I think culturally I was born in the 60s. I'm different than, you know, kids today. So how do I stay relevant? Maybe there's no answer. I don't know.
Well, I know one way.
So I believe you stay relevant by being flexible and constantly inquisitive, and at every opportunity continuing to build your knowledge and experience base, because that allows you insights that others absolutely do not have. Now, that's not to say that who you're working with will understand that fact, but you do. And if given the opportunity, what I just said will come clear. So for me, as I watch the world change and become constantly, continuously digital, I sought out a different kind of client who, you know, and these complex problems in the medical field that, you know, years earlier, I would never have tackled. I wouldn't have tackled it because, as you just said, I didn't have the knowledge and the confidence in my skill set to take on such projects.
Now, that's pretty good. I mean, you're right. You know, to be or stay relevant is being, you know, trying to be open-minded to many different things that are going to come across our desks. I think, you know, the best thing that we can do, I think, as leaders is really allowing the younger designers who have a lot of potential and a lot of ideas, but not necessarily the ability to help put all the connected tissue together in order to make this thing into a product or to have the relationships with the business leaders. And that's really where I think where we have to be really good and get better at is that sort of it's a lot of relationships.
I think there's definitely some certainly there's the aesthetic side, which, you know, changes all the time. But there's even sort of the, you know, an understanding of what an experience with a product should be or a device or whatever that, you know, that I think also shifts probably less frequently or less dramatically than sort of the aesthetic piece of it. But
I think, you know, the older you become, you become or remain more comfortable being wrong. And that's how you remain flexible and inquisitive and exploring options others would never consider. So it's navigating contradictions, and young designers have a difficulty doing that.
That's a great, I'm writing that down. Comfortable with being wrong.
Yeah, I mean, even, it's like, you know, here's an example, nothing to do with design, but Tony, you've probably experienced this as well. You know, when we were younger in our teens, you know, that was the big thing is once you got your driver's license, you were out the door and you had freedom. You know, my kids, I've had to push them to, you know, to get a license. They weren't interested. So for me, that's like a huge cultural shift, and maybe for the better, I don't know. But you know, that affects, you know, so that's just one example of probably a bigger shift in the generations. And then, you know, how does that, or what has influenced that sort of cultural shift, how does that then translate into sort of their appreciation or expectation and how they experience a thing that we would then be designing?
Right.
So, and how can you and I, and maybe that's the answer, right, from being from other generations, comprehend that since we didn't grow up with it, right?
Yeah.
In that way. So maybe this is a bit too sort of ethereal of a thing to discuss, but it's an interesting one.
So, Stephen, you mentioned, you know, you've seen so much change in the design world and the design field. I mean, when you started, you were doing like hand drawings.
I mean, everything.
Yeah, I mean, so years ago, I worked with ID2, which is Bill Moggeridge's firm out of Silicon Valley. And we worked on a wrist-worn pulse monitor. And the entire documentation, all the injection molding documentation, was graphite, hand-drawn graphite images. And all 3D. And of course, there was no computer, so you had to sit down and figure out the trick, all of it, and just to even draw it. So I worked with this amazing designer, engineer actually out of Stanford called Bob Yuan. And anyway, I pulled the drawings out one day to show Praska, and he was like, "What is this?" And of course, it shows you the dimensions and the tolerances and the whole nine yards. And it was all done by hand. And then, of course, now you get into the 3D visualizations and the finite element analysis that assure structural integrity. And I'm sure the next step is going to be complete simulation of the device in use, which is, I won't see that probably, or maybe I will, I don't know. But yeah, that's a leap. People have a difficult time understanding you sat at a desk with tools and you drew things.
Yeah, you know, my dad is still a practicing architect and he does a little bit of AutoCAD, but he also hand draws his drawings. If he's doing some simple house or some little addition, he'll just hand draw it, because it's faster. I can do it quicker.
Steven, so where do you see the future of design, or how do you you know, since you've experienced different phases, what do you think is the next phase for designers or as a, like the industry
you're,
as a whole?
You're asking him to predict the future.
Well, he might have.
So, I mean, you know, you can't help but read and watch what AI is doing. Sure. And that has to integrate or filtrate into the design field in some capacity. And will designers then become programmers? And that's how they manipulate. I believe designers will have to learn some degree of programming language, because it will be entire simulations of these devices. Yes, there will be people who still do the detail work. I don't have an answer for this, but I just know that instead of these meetings with clients to share preliminary concepts, what that's going to be is preliminary simulation showing the device in use and why the concept you're proposing maps with their expectations.
Actually, that's probably true. If you look at how things have gone, I think you're dead on, because, you know, you went from pencil sketches to, you know, marker renderings and, you know, to a more of a finished presentation. You know, that's how it was. And then there was early CAD and then very early sort of simulated renderings. And I think that's probably a good next step, right? Is, you know, how can you then utilize the technology to make it even more virtually real?
Right.
Well, yeah, with VR.
Remember the first time you saw a, you know, whether it was SolidWorks or whatever, Rhino, you know, where you saw the 3D image and you could rotate it and you're just kind of blown away by the fact, oh my God, that's what it's going to look like before we build it. That was very cool.
Yeah, it was changing. It was life changing. Right. Cause I remember when I first started working, I was working in 2D. It was on the computer, but it was still two dimensional
orthographics.
Yeah. Two dimensional drawings, and you'd send it to the model builder and kind of hope that, you're like, well, we'll see what it looks like when it comes in. So much has changed, and it's really cool. I mean, the idea of like being able to virtually see the product being used. I just saw some video that somebody had put on LinkedIn, and it was showing like how it was like a hand model, and he had the CAD of his object, and you could move the hand up and down the object, and the model would move.
Wow.
The fingers would move correctly around the object. I wish I could remember what it was called, but it was pretty neat. I'm like, well, that's kind of cool, because you could really tell, like, will your hand fit inside this thing? Will it hold it correctly?
Well, so maybe that is where the future is going, because you'll have these ultra intelligent programs, ergonomic programs that you can put the device into, and you tell it, you know, what hand, what fingers what's the reach of those, what's the limitation of reach of these fingers or the grasp or what have you, and it will self-correct the object's dimensions, you know, dynamically, like what currently takes place in FEA, at least the FEA program we had, which was before SolidWorks. It was absolutely amazing. So I could go from a 3D model into the finite element analysis, see where the weaknesses were, increase the cross sections automatically, and then re-render the device to see if I liked it. And that was stunning. And I suspect that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. I think you're right. We actually, here's an example of something. This, and I think this supports your idea. So we were involved in, or are still involved in, a little bit of a project where it's like a vehicle. And so this company, they brought the vehicle into this sort of virtual reality program and then combined it with a guy who was in this virtual reality space. And he got into the vehicle, sat down, and was able to then get a virtual ruler and measure, like, say, the distance from his knee to the dashboard. It was sort of, to me, so fascinating because it was a combination of, here's this sort of CAD virtual thing that doesn't exist other than, you know, ones and zeros, combined with, you know, here's a real person who's interacting with this in virtual environment and able to, you know, measure things of from him to this database of things. So
yeah, that's really wild.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
That's cool. Nice. So Stephen, you're retired. What's your plan? Like what are you going to be doing? You're going to be painting, you're going to be hiking.
Actually, I had wanted to spend time a couple of years ago I went to Portugal and thoroughly enjoyed Portugal and the Douro River, where all the port is. So if you go up that river, you're looking at, because it's not a wealthy country by any means, you're looking at 16th, 17th century ruins along the river that are just stunning. And I would love to investigate buying some property there, to be honest. Actually just hanging out. And if I can't do that, then so it's around travel. It's around going to different places and not just staying a day or two, but getting a place and in some out of the way neighborhood and getting up in the morning and just appreciating the culture, going to get coffee. Just it's a radical departure from design. In fact, I won't even be thinking about design. Well, yeah, I'll walk around, but it's that's what I'd like to do. But then our friend COVID got in the way, who knows when I'll be doing that.
I think that's a great you know, ending to a long career of design. I think, you know, it's always you know, these small design firms such as yours and Dan's, you know, I always find that those are the firms that kind of help keep design alive and keep the profession moving forward. It's not the big sort of Cadillac branded firms that everybody's heard about because they're just so small compared to the rest of us that actually practice.
No, I mean, I don't want to paint the impression that, operating a small enterprise wasn't challenging. It was.
Sure.
I mean, there's years where I was the only person who wasn't paid, and my employees were paid. I wasn't paid, but every year I made a commitment to myself that as an entrepreneur, what would get paid is my pension plan. And I had an elaborate pension plan. And I started that in 1994 when Frank and I, my partner, split. And every year religiously, I put money into that. And then I managed it. And that's why I'm in the position I'm in now. And otherwise, there were great times, and then there were times why you just ask yourself, why in the hell am I doing this? And can I continue doing this?
Yeah, I think every designer goes through some of those introspective conversations that they have. I think that's really great advice, you know, to that oftentimes when we're in design school, we're told about all the things that we need to read and learn about design, but the financial element of your personal finances, of how important that is, so that when you do get to this point, because all of us want to get to that point where we want to not work anymore and enjoy life, and that you really need to you got to think about it. So I'm staring at Aaron right now because he still has a he still has a two in front of his age.
I actually started like 2 years ago.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
I always tell people if they want to know what it's like, I say, well, hey, guess what? You know, the roof is, you know, is gone. The sky's the limit, but the floor's gone too. So you're going to go up and you're going to go down. So just get ready for it.
Well, I mean, you know, for me, it was, if I think about it, it's first learning how to run and market a business. Because as you just mentioned, Tony, I had no business background or finance background. And then the next issue was really learning how to attract and work with the right client, because I had some exceptional clients and I had some really bad clients. And clients I should never have accepted doing work for, because when I, anyway, and of course the last is the most obvious, which is attracting and retaining excellent designers and engineers. And that's the key to any entrepreneurial business in design, are those three issues in my mind.
Right.
You got anything to add to that, Dan? Good clients, bad clients?
I think fortunately for me, I've had a few clients that were good, but bad in other reasons, like they declared bankruptcy. So
I had those.
Yeah. I've been fortunate. I wouldn't say I've had anybody that I would say was a horrible client. So maybe that's just the luck of the roll of the dice.
You're very fortunate.
Yeah. I've had some customers that are just tougher to work with than others, just on a, I'd say, a personal level and kind of how they worked. But overall, it's been a good experience.
Well, I mean, so for me, it wasn't a matter of not paying necessarily, even though I ran into those situations where funds were no longer available. Yeah. And how is that resolved? But no, it's going through the initial interview, assuming we're on the same page, and then X months in, you realize factions of that client, of the, so for design to go well, management, marketing, engineering, manufacturing all have to be on the same page. And if one or two of those are not, then the design process is diluted or can become somewhat meaningless.
I would agree with you. I mean, that's almost for me the expectation of, okay, there's going to be certain parts of the company, and that's just their internal, you know, setup and process and politics. You know, are you going to sort of run into some difficulties along the way?
Yeah.
It's nice if they all line up, though, I tell you that. I agree with you.
Yeah.
So another thing that I guess I'll just jump in here with some other topics. So when I sat down in later stages of my career with clients, I would like to always understand, and sometimes they could articulate it, other times they were unwilling and just depends. But that was a telling story in and of itself, was what do you want the product to do? So is it a new product looking for a market niche? Is it a growing product trying to increase its market share? Or is it a dominant product protecting its space? Or are you asking me to help you with an aging product that where the it needs to you well we as a group need to revitalize the category? And last, is it a yet to be introduced technology that could transform a category completely? And those are always interesting conversations, because often they're not immediately understood.
Right.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Well, I think we should probably wrap it up. We've been talking for a little while, about 45 minutes. I want to ask one last question for you, Stephen, and it might spark a couple of other questions from the other guys. But I would ask you for people who are interested in going into design, or new designers, folks that are in college, what piece of advice would you want to give to those people?
I think it's no different than. That's a tough question because things have changed. I think education today has simplified the design process in ways that I don't agree with. So I'm having a problem. So I was asked to help the University of Washington in Seattle with their design curriculum. And the singular focus seemed to be on design thinking. And okay, that's well and good, but you have to understand what design thinking was developed for. It's a marketing tool to sell IDOs. It was a marketing tool to sell IDO services, and that's where it came from. And no one wants to acknowledge that fact. Instead, it's ballooned into this holy grail, and I'm not on board. Because design has always been about serving the end user. And so what's in play now is so it's not design, but you also need to understand sociology and psychology and engineering has been diminished. And I'm saddened by that fact because I worked with designers who had one or two of those skills, and they're very different people than the graduates I have the opportunity to work with. So I guess I would say to any graduate, you're going to have to go beyond what the university is telling you you need, because it's not enough. Open your eyes, get as much knowledge as you can outside the field of design as they're currently defining it. And I've seen the programs. I mean, I've worked with a number of Stanford grad people. Let's see. I actually had the opportunity to work with a new Stanford grad 6 years ago, and I was surprised at his. He didn't have the depth of knowledge that I thought the field needed, and I told him so. I mean, Bob Yuan, the guy I worked with on the wrist-worn pulse monitor, versus this gentleman, I was like night and day.
Was the message well received?
Of course not. No. He's still in the field today. He will remain in the field. He took it. It was done over a beer, and we had quite a conversation. Yeah. And I just said, you need to. I'm just surprised because that's when the David Kellys and the Bill Moggridges and the all of those dudes were teaching at Stanford, and they were amazing designers in and of themselves.
Yeah.
And it didn't stop with aesthetics. Never did.
Right. Nope. It shouldn't.
So are you seeing a disconnect between what the idea of design is and the goal is? So whereas right now it's becoming more, like you said, this design thinking idea, and it's losing the core of what you said is about.
Well, so what I'm saying is very specialized students with a narrow understanding of what design actually is. Most designers are not introduced with the thinking that there's a concept, an experience. But then who does the development? Well, that's someone else. Or the experience digitally is done by someone else. And then there's a person who does what it should look like versus an individual who attempts to tackle all of those things to assure integrity of an idea and the interests of the end user are not compromised somewhere along the process, somewhere along the way. I mean, the great designers you can think of, Tony, that, Mario Bellini, Taddeo Endo, Sapper, all those dudes. I mean, the concept or conceptual stage or one of these steps was just a step in a process. So anyway.
Well, I think.
Does that make any sense, or am I going off?
No, I love it. I think we could probably spend 2 hours just talking completely around that topic. But what you're talking about is, hence the name of the podcast, the design intent. Are you maintaining the design intent throughout the process? And
sure.
Dan and Aaron is starting to learn now, I'm sure. But it's like, to your point, you're starting somewhere at the beginning, and you have to work through with all these various disciplines to get to the end point. And you know, it's not an easy process. It's hard and challenging, and you can't just throw something on the table and expect it to maintain its integrity all the way through. Just like what you said, you have to be there. You have to be there to understand. You have to understand the context of what the person that you're working with is telling you that doesn't work. Like, why won't this work? You know, the engineer or the software engineer, the mechanical engineer, the thermal engineer, whoever it is that you're working with, there's always going to be some constraint that they're up against that you have to understand so that you can design around that particular problem, right? And I think that's what you're alluding to is.
No, you're summarizing it right on. I mean, it's. So when I started in the 70s and 80s, it was certainly an engineering-centric world, more so than it is today. So CEOs were all engineers of one kind or another that I worked with. Today, that's not the case. It's largely marketing. And it's also multidisciplinary. So the team that creates products today, 3D products, it's important to understand how to speak with a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer and create camaraderie. But also know from past experiences of one kind or another that what they're saying is right for the intent of the product, or it's not. And if it's not, then how are we going to solve this together, as you just mentioned? Or maybe in a corporate structure of one kind or another, they're unyielding. And so then it's up to you to figure out to solve their problem. And I've had to do that on many occasions, is find another soul to help me and say, here's a workaround that I think addresses the issue we've been discussing. And that's a part of design that's not discussed.
Yep, that's great. No, that's a great, that's perfect. That's perfect. Well, you guys got anything else, Dan?
I think that's good.
Aaron? Well, Stephen, it's really been awesome. Really appreciate it. It's great seeing you and talking to you. I knew it would be good, just getting your perspective. I remember, you know, really enjoying our conversations back when I met you, and we didn't really work together. I think you came to Intel a few times to kind of
I remember at the toy lab. Remember that?
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well,
yeah.
That's where we first met, was the toy lab. But
that's
then,
right.
We never really had the opportunity to dig into something, but. No, it's been a pleasure speaking with all of you. And Aaron, I wish you the best here as your career unfolds.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good
that.
To see you.
All right. Nice talking
and,
to you.
And you too, Dan.
Yeah.
So, and I always enjoy discussing the process and the history of design. Thank you.